You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
From various institutions, both national and diplomatic and UN type of institutions here based in Beirut. They have all been at least received the link to your paper. I'm sure some have read it, some maybe have not had the chance. Obviously, the issue of Syria looms very large here in Lebanon and among those who follow Middle Eastern affairs in this part of the region. And Russian perspective, the Russian policy on Syria is an issue of great, great interest and great importance. So we're all very eager to hear your views and to engage in a discussion with you about this. Just to say a few words about my colleague Dmitry. Dmitry used to be an officer in the Soviet military. He actually served in Iraq in the days of Saddam Hussein for a very brief period. But he has obviously since left the military. He's been effectively leading the Carnegie Middle East Center, the Carnegie Moscow Center, which is repeatedly ranked the leading Russian think tank, which does exceptional work on Russian domestic affairs and Russian foreign policy. And Dmitry, I would say, is maybe the most well-known commentator and analyst on Russian affairs around the world, and we're very happy and very lucky to have him with us today. The paper that he's written, which is published in English, it's in front of you on paper. It's also available on the website. We are working on an Arabic version of it, which will be out in the next few weeks, a paper that you can then revisit if you haven't already done so. Really excellent piece of analysis. And we have two colleagues here in Beirut to share their views, to react, and maybe to enter and lead a discussion with Dmitry. To my right is Jihad Zain, who is a leading journalist and columnist in the national newspaper, the Nahar newspaper, writes a lot on domestic Lebanese issues, but also a lot on the regional and international politics of the Middle East. And we're very happy to have Jihad with us today. To my left is my colleague Yazid Sayegh, who is a senior scholar at this Carnegie Middle East Center, and has worked a lot on security sector issues in the military and internal security, but also since the uprising in Syria has done a lot of work on the Syrian opposition and the Syrian crisis in general. So we'll start with, obviously, Dmitry. Give yourself 20-25 minutes to present the main views that were certainly presented in the paper and any sort of updates since the paper was published. After that, I will turn to my colleague Jihad on my right for about 10 minutes of his commentary and analysis, and then to my colleague Yazid for another 10 minutes. And then we open it up for questions or discussions from the audience. We hope to be finished at around 6 o'clock. So without further introductions, Dmitry, I turn it over to you, and hopefully the technology will continue to work.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for this. It's a wonderful opportunity for me to talk to you, talk to your audience. And with colleagues at the Carnegie Middle East Center for organizing this event. I thank my people here, especially my technical I'm glad that there is so much interest in the subject, and I'm glad that the paper is now being made available to an even larger audience in the Arab world. I believe that any paper, any text should actually stand on its own feet. I warmly encourage you all to look into the paper and give a little bit of thought to some of the things written there, because as you may guess from the title, The Mythical Alliance, the paper is actually aimed at challenging some of the myths that accompany description of Russia's position on the Syrian issue. The Syria is not, in my view, simply Russia's last remaining ally in the Middle East, a kind of a holdover from the days of the Cold War. I make a point early on that Russia has been de facto absent from Middle Eastern radically changed since the days of the Cold War, since the in the mainstream international media. I believe that a fuller understanding of Moscow's stance and Moscow's policies towards Syria could lead to more effective policies being pursued in, especially in Washington and in Europe, but also in parts of the Arab world, which would lead, hopefully, to a kind of international collaboration that would help stop the carnage in Syria. The paper starts with the number of people who had lost their lives in the Syrian conflict, and of course, I must say with a lot of grief that since the paper was published, the number has gone up considerably again. So basically this whole effort has been motivated by a desire to create more understanding so that more effective policies could be put in place and human lives could be saved as a result. I will not talk for a very long time. I really look forward to the feedback. I really look forward to you all sharing good news with me. I'm very eager to learn from you. So I will say just a few things before I turn the floor over back to you, Paul, back to your colleagues. I argue in the paper that the Russian position on Syria could be understood as a four-layered cake. At the top layer, you have concerns over what I call the world order. And this is essentially about the use of force in international relations. Who uses force? Who sanctions the use of force? Who monitors the use of force? Who sends troops? That kind of stuff. And Related to that is the issue of sovereignty, the issue of regime change, whether regime change is exclusively a matter for the people in a country to act upon or initiate and complete, or whether the international community has a role, or outside powers have a role in changing governments in a sovereign country. At this top layer, Russia's position was very much informed by the developments in Libya, where, of course, the Russians initially allowed the NATO-led intervention to proceed, only to feel themselves essentially deceived by the developments that that followed. And I think that this really was a major element in Russia deciding to take a different course of action in Syria. At the second layer of the Russian position is what I would call the assessment by the Russian government of the nature of the process known by the shorthand of the Arab Spring. Whereas for many people in the United States and in Western Europe, the Arab Spring was something akin to 1848 revolutions in Europe, or 1989 fall of the Berlin Wall, Velvet Revolutions in the Central Europe. For the Russians, this was more like 1917 revisited, yeah. Of course, the year of the Russian Revolution. And the only thing that was left as a question mark was which month would be the defining month. Would be more like February 1917, democracy replacing monarchy. Replacing democracy or proto-democracy, if you like, with totalitarianism. Nowadays, I think most Russian analysts and the Russian government agree that discussions that are talking more about. The internal situation in Syria may be
Thank you, Dimitri. Thank you very much. We heard you perfectly on the technical side and hope you can hear our commentators as well. And thank you for those bullet point emphases. As you said, there's no substitute to reading this very analytical, very well-crafted paper, and obviously I urge everybody here to do so if they haven't already done so. I will turn first to Mr. Jihad Zain for his comments.
I will talk in English only because Carnegie has asked me to do that. The paper of Dmitry Trenin is a combination of an analytical paper and a policy paper. I would like to congratulate the author for two main elements in it. First, his comprehensive approach to the Russian policy. Second, his objectivity, since he discussed throughout his research, in every point he addressed, all the political views which he does not embrace or even disagrees with them. This is an inclusive study about the Russian perspective under Putin's rule and how it developed regarding the international relations and the situation in the Middle East and the Arab world. As matter of fact, it is a study about the internal Russian experience, or what the researcher calls the four layers of the Russian policy. In spite of the fact that the study leaves no doubt that the Russian support of the Syrian regime is a decisive stance on Syria, it is surprising that he does not refer to the Russian relationship with the Syrian regime as an alliance or a strategic relationship, but prefers to call it the contrary, the mythical alliance. I would say here, if the reader builds on the analysis and arguments of Dmitry Trenin throughout the paper, he would reach a conviction that is in total contradiction with the Trenin's findings, or at least the title of his study. The paper, in my opinion, is a must read. I cannot find anything more compelling to convince whomever that Russia is developing a full strategic policy in Syria and that is totally allied to the regime better than Dmitry Trenin paper. This alliance is not mythical at all. It has reached a level of involvement that makes it in charge of the military management of the fight at the level of planning and military support in the operations room, which inevitably exists under Russian command and with the participation of Iran, while the Syrian side, the arm of the regime, is in charge of the military action on the ground. This exists opposite to the operations room of the revolution that also inevitably includes a Turkish-French-American military command to guide and support the Syrian opposition fighter. So my main disagreement with the author, is not about the really strong arguments of his study, but about the paper's title and conclusion. All fact have shown that the Russian stance is final and decisive, despite all betting on a change of that stance. The researcher tells us that Russia has come to refuse its exclusion at the international level after the fall of the Soviet Union, and that it has realized after the Chechnya experience the severity of the impact of the Islamist fundamentalist factor on the situation in North Caucasus, which is a part of the Russian land. Moreover, the author says that for Russia, the Arab Spring is nothing more than an Islamist spring, and the Muslim Brotherhood is a terrorist organization. The Kremlin is also, by the author, and I agree, irritated at U.S. attempts to turn the Arab Spring into a potential Russian Spring inside Moscow itself to topple President Putin. He adds that Russia as a state relies on a clear display of its religious identity in alliance with the Orthodox Church and other consideration. When we talk about the Orthodox Church and the identity of Russia, he mentioned the Orthodox pilgrims heading to Jerusalem. The author tells us all that with accuracy and objectivity. However, he wants us to accept the title of his study and to a certain extent his conclusion that the Russian policy on the Syrian crisis does not amount to a strategic alliance with the regime. The alliance is not mythical at all. Apart from that, I have some question for the researcher. One, what about the current activity of Islamists, jihadists, and fundamentalists in area of Muslim character in Russia, such as Dagestan and others? This question might be turned into a proposal for a study about this fundamentalist activity inside Russia in the post-Chechnya insurgency era. Two, while addressing the potential common denominators of any Russian-American action in Syria, the author calls for the isolation of the opposition figures that totally reject dialogue with the Syrian regime. How would an American-Russian agreement achieve this in the light of the power and influence of this rejectionist movement that remains the most powerful abroad in spite of some infiltrations into its ranks? Three, we also need to learn more about the role of the Orthodox Church in the development of this Russian role in Syria, especially in terms of its vision for the region's Christians, because what we are witnessing after the Syrian revolution is a real alliance between the various churches of the region with the support, the implicit full support of the Vatican. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jihad, very, very much. Really, those were very useful comments and very precise questions. And after we hear also from Yazid, certainly we'll go back to Dimitri for some responses to both of you before going to the discussion. I turn the floor to my colleague Yazid.
Thank you, Paul. What I intend to do is to use Dimitri Trenin's paper as a starting point to think about where the Syrian conflict goes next. And here I want to start by referring to a point made by Dimitri in his presentation towards the end about Russia not having a real interest, and in fact all the external actors not having a real interest in Syria. And I think this is an extremely important insight and one we need to draw conclusions from. If you think back a little bit to just over a year ago when Russia and China first used their veto, and in particular the second time in early February 2012, to block a Security Council resolution on Syria, Western responses at government level were unusually vehement and frank and offensive, I think. And it's striking that the Western governments went beyond the usual norms of diplomatic nicety, etc. And I think, ironically, that this actually gave proof, if anything, that they weren't that serious about Syria, that they didn't have so much at stake in Syria, and they could afford this type of fundamentally counterproductive political dynamic with Russia and, of course, China. And this, I think, raises a paradox for us still today, 2 years on into the Syrian crisis, that both Russia and the Western camp, the US and the EU, are at loggerheads over a situation in which neither has a real stake. And I think the implication of that is that neither is truly invested, therefore, in what officially both are committed to, which is achieving a political solution in Syria. This requires investment, and I think they're both at the stage where neither is really ready or interested in making that sort of investment. Now, I want to take that further forward in terms of where does the Syrian crisis go next, with, of course, the issue here being what this means for Russian policy and what we may expect. First, I want to emphasize in my assessment that the Syrian conflict or crisis will not end the way the U.S. intervention in South Vietnam ended in 1975 in April, where the last U.S. Marine left Saigon holding on to a helicopter leaving the embassy roof. The last Russian advisor will not leave Damascus clinging to a helicopter skid. In other words, what I'm saying is I don't think, despite all appearances and drama, that the endgame in Syria will be one of a total regime collapse in which regime forces disappear, fall apart, disintegrate, and the rebels move in and take everything over. What is more likely, I think, is that as the regime loses the ability to deter or prevent the emergence of elements from within its own system, i.e. the state apparatus, the Ba'ath Party, and the army itself, once the regime is weakened enough, I think the more likely course of events will be for what I would refer to as a third force to emerge that presents itself as able to run the country, stabilize transition, deal with threats such as jihadists, bring the army, the Ba'ath Party, and the Alawi community on board, all of which are crucial if there is in fact to be a stable transition and if government services and administration and so on are to in fact function. And if a third force of this type does appear, as I think it is likely to, then I think that both the Russians, but also the Western camp, will turn to this third force as their preferred option, inviting all other parties, including, of course, in particular, the opposition, to come to the table with representatives of these state institutions. And I think this is likely under pretty much all circumstances. Whether the regime, in fact, is forced to abandon Damascus and leave to, supposedly, as some believe, a Alawi refuge in the north, even in that case, I think this is precisely the sort of situation in which those large sections of the state apparatus or the army or the Ba'ath Party, local government, who have so far not defected and have been unwilling to defect for a variety of reasons, this is when I think they will not wish to leave the capital, which is the seat of all these institutions and of the middle class and of the business class in Syria. They aren't simply going to disappear. They're neither going to abandon the city. They don't have that option, unlike, let's say, the Assad family, who could go to the mythical Alawi partition state. But these people do not have that option, and I think that is when they will appear in one guise or another. So whichever scenario we think is the most likely, in all of these cases, I think we're talking about important institutional actors being part of that transition under one form or another. And this, after all, is precisely where Russia has an interest, both in seeing the stability of institutions, the continuity of institutions, and these are, moreover, the institutions, whether the party, the civil service, the state-owned economy, and, of course, the military and security services, with which Russia has had the longest and most intimate relationship for many years through training and through hosting people in Russia or previously the Soviet Union and so on. So I think it's clear that in all these cases, Russia is geared to play an important role. And this, of course, is precisely why so many Western diplomats, government officials, media pundits, op-ed writers, and so on, emphasize why Russia needs to be brought in. The problem, of course, here is that everyone expects Russia to deliver an outcome that none of these Western powers themselves are willing to bring about, to invest the political capital, the military or material capital to bring about. And it's another one of the paradoxes, which is why should Russia deliver a result that it may or may not be able to actually achieve, but that basically the other parties should be delivering and that they're unwilling to deliver. Now, the further implication here, I think, is to, well, first, as Dmitry Trenin suggests in his paper, that the West needs to approach Russia differently in order to get Russia engaged differently. And I think that is certainly important. However, at the same time, it's pretty clear to me that Russian decision makers have to also approach the Syrian question and the West differently as well. Because no matter how things turn out in Syria, I don't think any form of transition will keep this regime and this structure intact. There will be any other form, whether it's a unitary state, a federal state, a partition state, even a Somali-Afghanistan-style state, which is what Dmitry referred to earlier. In all these cases, if Russia doesn't want this outcome or wants to have influence in this outcome, it too has to start coming to terms with the fact that all the most likely scenarios are different than the one it preferred from the start of the crisis. Now, the last set of remarks I want to make relate to what we might call the post-conflict situation. In other words, these scenarios, not only for how the endgame will unfold, but what the final solution or deal might be in Syria. Now here, Dmitry Trenin ends his paper with a reference to the Dayton Agreement of 1995 that ended the Bosnia-Herzegovina conflict. Of course, all those in Lebanon who follow events and who are, you know, hear a reference will also think of the Taif Agreement, with which, of course, the Lebanese Civil War ended. And in both cases, we're talking about a political solution that is engineered around communal identity, basically, whether it's ethno-national or sectarian national. I think the suggestion that the Dayton option is one that is likely for Syria, or that the outside parties might actually work towards, we have to think seriously about that, both in terms of whether, in fact, a Dayton-type agreement is a good idea, whether it would be stable, and just because it's sort of held together not very well in Bosnia-Herzegovina, that doesn't mean it will hold as well at all in the case of Syria. But I think what Russia also needs to do, and we also need to bring into our own thinking, is that even if there is to be something like a unitary state in Syria, this may take one of several different shapes. It may look more or less like the Syria that we've always known, where there's a central power based in Damascus with maybe more autonomy for Kurds or for the regions here and there. But it might also, in fact, have much greater autonomy of the Kurds. It may or may not include an Alawi region that is distinctly has some form of autonomy. And, of course, it may be even worse with warring cantons run by different bits of the state, what's left of the state, by different warlords, which is less than unitary, I accept. But anything that is less than total anarchy, again, is likely to pose Russia, since this is what interests us here, with dilemmas and challenges. If the Kurds in Syria gain a lot of autonomy, this then factors into relations with Turkey, with Iraq, and of course raises the whole issue of energy, because part of the whole point about Kurdish autonomy in Syria is its relationship to the lifting and transport of energy from northern Iraq. And this is therefore of direct importance for Russia. It already has strained relations with Turkey. It's got complicated relations on the other fronts in terms of energy in the Eastern Mediterranean, of gas supply, and so on. And so how it would maneuver in that sort of situation is not obvious. Were there to be something like a Alawi region in Syria that had some autonomy, then that might well be where Russia has the most historic, social, institutional, personal training relations. But that might not be where it needs to have its strongest relations and strongest influence. It might need to have them, in fact, in the capital, as always. And this, too, will pose dilemmas and challenges for exactly how Russia works out its presence in a future Syria. To conclude, if all else fails, and there isn't a negotiated solution, no third force appears, the opposition doesn't manage some sort of dialogue with parts of the state, will Russia and the West finally, at some point in the bloodshed, develop a joint approach? Or, as we heard, and I think this is both realistic and, of course, very worrying, will the fact that neither Russia nor its Western counterparts have any really major interest in Syria result in an inability to develop a joint approach, given in particular that the issues at stake in the Russian-US dialogue to do with and with the Europeans over energy, over strategic issues, over Iran, are far more important for all those actors? And does this really mean that at the end of the day, the outcome in Syria will only be decided really through violence and by actors on the ground, without the sort of engagement that brings about moderation, negotiation, as we saw in Bosnia-Herzegovina finally or in other locations? And I'll stop there.
Thank you, Yazid, very much also for very rich comments, which complement the paper and add a lot of perspective and a number of key questions about the situation in Syria moving forward. Dimitri, let me give you a chance first to respond to these two panelists who are with me here in Beirut before then taking questions and comments from our audience. Thank you, Dmitry, for those responses. Let me now turn to our audience here in Beirut for some comments or questions. Please introduce yourself and pose your comment or question. The floor is open. Let's start with Dr. Shab at the end there.
Bassem Shab, I'm a member of parliament. I have a comment and a question. The Russian position really puts a lot of Christendom in jeopardy in Syria right now. As we well know, in the eastern provinces of Syria, the Christians under Kurdish control, and the Christians in the Aleppo area under fundamentalist Islamic influence. And the position of the Vatican and the position of the Greek Orthodox Church has not done much to help these Christians who are already under political influence that is against Bashar al-Assad and against this Russian policy that you have talked about. But the Russian position in general has given the Greek Orthodox community, which is still under Bashar al-Assad, a false sense of security. And my question is, should the regime fall pretty soon? What would happen to this Greek Orthodox community that has been promised some sort of protection by the Russian policy? And my second question is, with the introduction of chemical weapons in Aleppo, would that, do you think, change the current stalemate? Thank you.
Dmitry? Thank you, Dimitri. I have a question myself. In your paper, you emphasize a lot the importance of Russian-U.S. cooperation in order to find a solution to this crisis. And I would like your views a bit. How would you put this, the issue of the Syrian crisis, in the context of general U.S.-Russian relations at this time? George W. Bush started on a very good relationship with Vladimir Putin, saying he could trust him, he could work with him. By the end of the Bush years, of course, they were almost enemies. It had ended with the war in Georgia and other things. Barack Obama, in his first term, started with the famous reset of relations with Russia. And then, towards the end of his first term, there was not much to show for that. He was caught on an open microphone telling Medvedev at the time that after my re-election, I will be able to reach out to President Putin, or at the time Prime Minister Putin, and discuss many issues. Also, given the fact that neither the Russian nor the American best case or, you know, wished for outcome is at all going to take place, in other words, Russia maybe hoped or thought that in the beginning this would be over in a few months, that with a robust response from the Assad regime backed by Russia and others, this insurgency would be over. The Americans at one point expected that, like in other Arab countries, in a few months the regime would fall and they would pick up the pieces. I think it's fair to say at this point that, as you are saying, the Russians realize that the regime in its present form is over and that some negotiation and resolution is necessary, and I think the U.S. and the West realizes that the rebels or the opposition is not going to win militarily and certainly no time soon, and hence some middle ground might be needed. And since that would have to start from the top, from a U.S. And Russian discussion, particularly because in the Middle East region there is no middle ground, there is no movement towards intervention. The Taif Agreement, as Yazid mentioned, there was a regional, you know, Saudi Arabia was involved, there was regional mediation and regional middle ground, if you will. None of that exists. The region is now pouring flames into Syria. The Syrians themselves, even unlike perhaps the Lebanese, do not have a domestic process where they are reaching out to each other and talking about anything. So if there's any hope in the next year or year and a half, it will have to come from Moscow and Washington. My question to you is, where do you see today in March 2013, after the U.S. re-election, after Putin's re-election and dealing with his own challenges at home, what are the hopes for, in a sense, another reset of general U.S.-Russian relations? What are the major issues that perhaps they could move forward on, within which then a bargain on Syria could be contemplated? Right now, as maybe Yazid indicated, partly they don't have enough interest in Syria to actually bother to negotiate. And I would add to that, they're not negotiating over over other things also at the same time. So there's no mood for moving forward. Could that change in the foreseeable future? Thank you, Dimitri. Tfaddal.
General retired Ilyas Farhad. The Syrian issue between the United States and Russia is discussed among other issues. So, as we notice, it will take long time between the two superpowers to find a settlement or to conclude a settlement for the Syrian conflict. My question is why they don't delegate, say, their influence to regional powers as Turkey and Iran. If Turkey and Iran met with backing of Russia and the United States, they may soon find a resolution for the Syrian conflict, because they are involved to some extent in the conflict and they know better what's going on the ground, instead of waiting a phone call from Obama to Putin or a meeting which is now expected in March, then we'll say about postponed to September. Second question is that we've heard about the United States canceled the phase four of the missile shield against Russia in Europe. And there are also some news about gas contracts between Russia and Israel and Qatar. Does this affect on the Russian stand towards the Syrian crisis?
They want Iran in, they want Saudi Arabia clearly in, as well as the P5. So they want everyone in. Now, it's fine, but like in any committee, you need some leadership. And I do not know to what extent Turkey and Iran, even acting together, I'm speaking very plainly as a military person to a military person. I do not know to what extent Turkey and Iran today could exercise that kind of leadership. I do not know to what extent Egypt, for example, could exercise that leadership. I do not know to what extent Saudi Arabia's leadership could be acceptable to many others. So it's as I understand, it's a very complex part of the world. I would hope that in the best scenario, everyone takes part in the solution. Everyone is there around the table. Everyone has a chance to present their legitimate interests so that those be recognized by others, of course, within the larger international context of the settlement. But I believe that there must be leadership exercised at the top level. In a different age, that could have been done single-handedly by the United States. The Bosnia thing was done by the United States. Dayton was all U.S. Everyone else, including Russia, were just present at the creation, but they were not doing much. Now, in this situation, Russia's role, Russia's way is incomparable to that of the United States today. China is not there yet. But I think that in this very special situation, Russia could rise above its level of a middling power, let's say, and do something bigger. Which would enhance Russia's standing and which would be a good thing, because Russia would be delivering some regional public goods. So I'm not against Turkey and Iran playing a very important role. I just don't think that it's realistic to expect them to lead on that process. We could also remember that the Turks and the Brazilians at some point tried to help resolve the Iranian nuclear issue. And it did not go very far. It's not that the six powers have been able to achieve the result, but the Turkish-Brazilian thing was not particularly successful. Now, the American decision, Obama's decision about the fourth phase is very important, I think. And that creates, this is the kind of flexibility that Obama may have had in mind. The gas contracts with Israel and Qatar, of course they are very important. I think Russia is sensitive to the damage done to its prestige in the Arab world. It publicly prefers not to worry, not to bother, but in reality, it's something that jars with Russian politicians and diplomats. They don't want that. So a successful settlement to the Syrian issue would upgrade Russia as a global player. Russia still sees itself as a great power, whatever it means today. And Russia has some interests in the region which are linked to gas, which are linked to some other things, not so much to geopolitics these days. So I would say that there's some developments recently, including this decision by President Obama, that make Russian-U.S. rapprochement on Syria slightly more realistic than a few weeks ago.
Yes, over there.
Hi, my name's Oliver Holmes from Reuters News Agency. My question relates to what you were just talking about, Russia's role is incomparable to the US. Since the first Russia-China veto, US officials have been saying that they can't do anything on Syria because of the Russians. And I don't actually believe this to be true. I think if the US wanted to do something about Syria, they would go ahead and do it. And the Russian position has been used to justify inaction by the US. And it makes me think about how Russia's influence in the world and how it's been seen as a power has grown during the Syria crisis. And this might be something that could prevent the Russians from being willing to come and discuss a resolution to the Syria crisis. Because I wanted to ask you, do you think the extension of the Syria conflict empowers Russia? And does the status quo at the moment actually help Russia and is in Russia's interests?
I would agree with you, first of all, that if the United States wanted to do something, i.e., let's say, intervene in Syria, they would be perfectly able to do that. Russia would not have prevented the United States had the U.S. decided to go in. And I think that the Russians said it publicly. I think it was Lavrov who said it, that if someone wanted to intervene in Syria, there's nothing we could do about that, except to brand it as illegal in terms of international law. And I think that's been the Russian position all along. And in that case, in that sense, I also agree with you when you were suggesting that Russia has been made a scapegoat by people in the West not willing to follow up with action, having called Assad's regime criminal, having said that the Assad regime's days are numbered and all that. You said all those very powerful, strong things, and then you did nothing. This is bad, clearly, and you need to have some kind of a reason why you were not able to do what you said was necessary. And there is this Russia that is that's a useful scapegoat. Again, as a Russian, I'm not happy with Russia being used and misused in this situation. And this is something that Russian foreign policy should be thinking about and should be doing something about. Now, so I agree with you on two or three counts. I would disagree with you on just one count, and this is the notion that the continuation of the Syrian crisis empowers Russia. Russia these days is not about about rivalry with the United States and the Middle East. Not everything that's... let me put it differently. Russia sees, I think, the real problem in the radicalization of that part of the world, the part of the world where you all sit. And that, I think, is seen by the Russians as a very serious danger. And Syria, in that scheme of things, is their exhibit number one. They do not want Syria to turn into an Afghanistan, if you like. Because of Dagestan, because of Northern North Caucasus, because of all the other things. So Russia is... the fact that Russia is mentioned in the international media most often these days because of Syria is a small comfort. If Syria turns into a cauldron of tension and a generator of extremism. But there are people in Russia who say, why should we be so negative on U.S. intervention anywhere in the world? Let them intervene. Let them go into Syria. Let them go into Iran. They will break their neck. The price of oil will skyrocket and will be the beneficiaries. Of course, this is all very cheap talk and irresponsible talk, and serious people, including Putin, do not buy that talk because the Russian leadership is not a bunch of gamblers. They're a bunch of pretty conservative people for whom money means, if not everything, then close to everything in this world. They're very energized these days about what's happening, again, close to you in Cyprus. This is more of a problem to them today than almost anything else that's going on in the world. It's their money. It may not be a lot of money. For a country like the United States, again, we're incomparable, the two countries, the U.S. and Russia, but even if it's, a few $1 billion worth of your assets, you would be very, very concerned. So the Russians are very money conscious, they're very conservative, they're very much focused on Russia, not so much on the rest of the world, and that's the big difference between Russia as the Russian Federation and Russia as the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union would go and spend zillions on some geopolitical scheme, on some ideological scheme somewhere in the world. The Russians go abroad in order to earn money, not to spend money.
Let me also say إنه اللي بيحب يسأل كمان بالعربي بيقدر يسأل بالعربي ممكن نترجم. Please, sir.
Yes, I'm General Qasim Jamoul from Research and Strategic Center in the Lebanese Army. Sir, you didn't mention about the new world order that been tried to be recreated by Russia and China. I think the relation between U.S. and Russia is much more than what you just mentioned about. I think there is now call Putin as a tiger, and you know it. So there is now trying to make a new world order. Russia is trying, and China also, trying to put aside the hegemony of U.S. as far as after the Soviet collapse. And this is a main reason for this conflict that is taking now in Syria, and now it will take long time because there is no way in the short period that this new world order to be created or be stabilized. Thank you.
General, I think that the new order is, is clearly changing, and we're all talking about that. There's this right of Asia, which is a popular expression, one of the more popular expressions in the global media and in the global analytica. And there's also a lot of talk about the decline of the West. So those are the two sides of the same coin. That has far less to do with any machinations between Moscow and Beijing, and it has much more to do with the economic rise of China, with the emergence of India as an important economic player, the emergence of Brazil, and clearly all major economic players after a certain level they tend to become or seek to become major political actors, and they want to back their political activism with some real military force. That's why Brazil is now building nuclear subs. And you would ask them, you'd ask the question, why, what for? And they would say, you know, we're a great power. And we want to have nuclear subs. And some people maintain that there can be no real great power if it doesn't have nuclear weapons, and this was the Indian argument, of course. So I think that Russia and China are clearly unhappy about U.S. domination, and they are combining forces to reduce that domination, which they have been doing for the past 15 years or so. But this is not something that has become an obsession, either with Beijing or even with Moscow. Beijing is extremely pragmatic about those things. Beijing is very much focused on the United States, but it sees the United States very differently from the way the Soviet Union saw the United States. It's not primarily a military threat. It's not an ideological alternative. It's an opportunity and a challenge. And this is what the Chinese are dealing with, and this is what the Chinese are trying to manage. Now, the Chinese are clearly the driving force behind, in any tandem you can think of between Russia and China. It's the Chinese. The Russians are an add-on, more or less, at this level. Although in Syria, clearly, the Russians are taking the lead, and the Chinese are very much sitting in the shade. Putin has a problem. It's not that only that he's called whatever, but if you remember, there was a nice cartoon on the cover of The Economist on Christmas Day, which had Mr. Putin burning in hell alongside Assad and Ahmadinejad, and there was Gaddafi floating somewhere nearby. And this, I think, more or less depicts where a lot of people in the West see Mr. Putin. I don't think Mr. Putin pays any attention to it today. I think he dismisses those people his political enemies, his detractors or would-be detractors. But it's also a problem for the West. If Mr. Putin is placed in the same company, in the Western eye, if he is placed in the same company as Ahmadinejad and Assad, how can you reach out to him to have an agreement on anything? You do not count the Ahmadinejads and the Assads of this world among the people with whom you can have a decent conversation, not to speak of a serious agreement. So in my view, the West has gone a little bit too far for its own good in painting Mr. Putin a bit blacker than Mr. Putin may deserve to be painted. And I see it as a real problem. It takes a lot of courage for a Western leader to sit down with Mr. Putin and have a conversation. To say something positive about Putin is just, you don't even think of it. It limits the options that people have. And I think it compares badly with the record of other leaders in the non-Western world with whom Western leaders have to deal with as a matter of necessity, if you like, in global politics. So I think I would stop.
Thank you. ممكن كان عندنا سؤال للسيد شري. وإذا بتحب تسأل بالعربي أو بالإنجليزي.
إذا بتسمحوا لي بالعربي ماشي يكون أوضح. فقط تعليق على الجواب اللي قبل شوي عن أنه الولايات المتحدة فيما لو أرادت أن تتدخل في سوريا لتدخلت بمعزل عن الموقف الروسي وأن الموقف الروسي لن يكون ليس إلا زريعة. إذا صح هذا الموقف بتصير الموقف الروسي موقف هامشي وكل ما ذكرناه في هذه المحاضرات شيء ثانوي وكأن الساحة السورية أصبحت ساحة لاعب واحد وساحة الولايات المتحدة الأمريكية وهذا شيء ما بعتقد أنه بالمنطق السياسي له حيز كبير أثناء النقاش. هذه شغلة أولية. شغلة تانية أنه روسيا بالعكس لها الكثير وتستثمر الكثير في سوريا ولم يعد لها في المنطقة غير سوريا. يعني لم يعد لروسيا الموطئ القدم الوحيد بالبحر المتوسط وبمنطقة النفط وبمنطقة الصراع العربي الإسرائيلي وبمنطقة الملف النووي الإيراني غير روسيا. روسيا تقاتل أن تستخدم الفيتو روسيا من أجل سوريا فهذا شأن كثير وتوظف الكثير تخاطر بسمعتها اللي أشار عنها قبل قليل في العالم العربي وهي ليست يعني لا تأسف عليها لأن ليس لسوريا لروسيا شيء أصلا في العالم العربي. يعني ما هو حجم المصالح الروسية في منطقة النفط أو في شمال أفريقيا بعد ما حصل في ليبيا وبعد ما حصل أين هي المصالح الروسية التي تأسف عليها روسيا؟ روسيا بالعكس أرى أنها تقاتل وتقاتل بشدة وقد حققت مكاسب كبيرة من خلال دورها في سوريا وهي مستمرة في المنازلة. بالنسبة للحوار أشار الدكتور يزيد أنه الطرفين ربما أو الدكتور ديمتري أن الطرفين لا يريدون حوار. طيب روسيا عبرت عن أرادتها بالحوار وتعهدت من جانب النظام السوري أنها مستعدة للحوار مع المسلحين. الرفض يأتي من الطرف الآخر مش عم بحكي عن أطراف السوريين حتى عن أطراف دوليين الذين يرفضون ويطرحون شروطا تعجيزية تعني أنه لا يريدون حوارا.
Dimitri, I will try to translate. Let me get the camera set again. The gentleman raised three points. The gentleman raised three points. The first, he said it's rather dangerous and inaccurate to say that the U.S. can do and could do anything in Syria if it wished.
that is not the case. It doesn't have that amount of leeway and freedom. The second point he raised is that he feels that Russia, the only interests Russia has in the Middle East are in Syria, and hence the Russian position, he believes, has a lot to do with those few remaining interests, that Russia really has nothing else in the Middle East, and even though what's in Syria might not be enormous, it's still the only thing they have in the region, and that must be motivating the degree to which they have gone to the Security Council and other places to counter policy. The third point relating to dialogue, he made the point that the Russians have said that they're in favor of dialogue. They want to be a part of leading that, participating in that, and urging their friends in Syria and perhaps in the region to be part of it. The rejection has come from the supporters of the Syrian opposition. He's not talking about inside Syria, but the supporters of both sides, that Russia has said it's willing and interested to lead such a thing, but that the others have rejected that outright. Any comments you would like to make on those points?
Thank you, Paul. And I very much respect the views of the gentleman, and I may politely disagree with one or two points that he's made. I clearly agree that although in principle the United States has a lot of power to deliver its munitions to just about any place in the world, the United States would be foolish to exercise all that power mindlessly. And I think that with President Obama, the United States has a leader who is more judicious with the use of force than both his than clearly his predecessor. And President Obama is clearly someone who doesn't have an appetite for heavy American involvement in another war in a Muslim country. I think I would agree and disagree with Russia clearly does have interests in Syria, and you may say that there are more Russian interests in Syria than the interests in other countries. I would say that from the standpoint, and I know why it may look that way, but from the vantage point of someone who is a very hard-headed Russian salesman who looks at the Middle East, I do not think that Syria would pop up first. I think that in terms of which countries are most important as clients, as buyers of Russian weaponry, Algeria will be number one. And there's a lot of money to be made in Algeria because Algeria is rich, and Syria is not as rich as Algeria. As to Russia being in favor of a dialogue, I think that I basically said that for Russia the issue is not to save Bashar al-Assad. And I think Putin was absolutely right. I do not often praise President Putin, but I think he was absolutely right when he said in Paris during a press conference, when he was asked a question about Russia's support for Bashar al-Assad, he said, "Bashar al-Assad often comes to this town, or used to come to this town much more often than he came to Moscow." And this is absolutely true. They do not regard him in Moscow as a real political or military ally at all. So the issue is to engage the Syrians in some kind of a dialogue that would lead to a negotiated solution. And I just checked the Russian Foreign Ministry's website just before coming to this conference with you, and the latest thing on Syria was the statement by the Russian
foreign ministry spokesman who very much deplored the most recent comments by the newly elected prime minister of the opposition that rejects dialogue with the with Damascus. And they said in that statement that they were encouraged by the previous statements by Mazar Khatib dating back to February, which suggested that Al-Habib was prepared for some kind of a dialogue with the authorities, and Moscow, of course, was very supportive of that. But now they're saying that the Russian foreign ministry, the opposition coalition, has gone back to the days of the Doha resolution in Doha statement of November 2012, and this is very unhelpful. So this is the latest that you can find on the Russian foreign ministry's website on Syria.
Could you, if there's perhaps a last question or comment? Anybody? Yes?
Benjamin Redd, Executive Magazine here in Beirut. Going back to the regional question, you mentioned in the paper, and you've mentioned here today, that Moscow isn't playing any sort of like regional hegemonic game, as was the case during the Cold War in the Middle East. However, everything is connected, to repeat a truism. And I'm just wondering, what is the Kremlin's view on the Syrian question with respect to what's going on with the P5 plus one negotiations with Iran? And also, if you could throw in there, you mentioned in the report that the relationship between Moscow and Riyadh has deteriorated. What is the current status of that relationship?
I think that from the standpoint of Moscow strategists, Kremlin strategists, Syria is a case of a war by proxy in which Saudi Arabia is fighting Iranian influence in the Middle East. The United States is not in the driver's seat, nor is it leading from behind. The United States is involved in this situation, but not as a leader of any kind. It's driven mostly by Saudi interests, and the idea is, of course, to rob Iran of its Shiite empire. That may be an extreme view, but this is a view I think widely shared by a lot of people in Russian political circles. As to the P5 plus one, I think that the Russians, of course, they are very much in favor of a resolution to the Iranian nuclear issue, because they would be hurt by either Iran becoming a nuclear weapons state or with missiles, or Iran being attacked by the United States or the United States and Israel and turning into a hotbed of another war. The Russians want to prevent both of those scenarios, and the only way to do that would be through a negotiated solution that would give Iran some security guarantees and some capability to enrich uranium in exchange for very intrusive inspections and all that, and lifting of the sanctions and inspections, everything in one package. I think that the Russians are very much in favor of a solution, but they clearly understand, as I think we all do, that the whole thing is not about the P5 plus one and Iran. The whole thing is about Iran and the United States, and even about what happens within Iran and what the United States may come up with eventually. So it's about Tehran and Washington deciding on the future of their relationship with everyone else, more or less, in a secondary situation. If the Syrian issue, as some people suspected, signaled some kind of an attack against Iran through Syria, then the prospects did not bode well for a solution to the nuclear issue. And on the contrary, some people clearly thought that the Syrian crisis was a prelude to a war against Iran, like the war, the civil war in Spain, or the intervention in Spain in the 1930s, was a prologue, a prelude to the Second World War in Europe. On the Moscow-Riyadh relationship, I think that the Russians cannot afford, really, to antagonize Saudi Arabia. They have been very careful when they happen to disagree with some important regional players. It's one thing to engage in a very loud slinging match with the United States. The Russians have been doing that for a long time. They got used to that. They know the limits. They know the rules of the game. But they know that if they were to antagonize a major regional power, then the price would be much heavier, and they will get no benefit of being seen challenging the superpower. So Moscow has been treading very carefully with Riyadh, trying to continue the conversation with them, trying to talk it out. Similarly, as with Turkey, someone mentioned in this discussion that the relationship between Moscow and Ankara has been pretty tense, also on the account of Syria. But the Russians have been extremely careful not to allow that disagreement to undercut the otherwise fairly good relationship and mutually beneficial relationship that they've built with Turkey. There's a lot of business going on between the Russians and the Turks. They don't want that to suffer because of the disagreement in Syria or over Syria.
Well, I'd like to thank you, Dmitry, very, very much for the paper and for joining us today by video conference. One last question. Dmitry, one last question. We need the camera to be moved, please, Robert.
I would like, I'm Dr. Riyad Shahi. I would like to ask Dr. Dmitry about the situation now with respect to the Syrian crisis. We heard a lot about the American and the Soviet position now with respect to the Syrian crisis. But really, there is a new player or another player here who are the Europeans, who are they take a little bit a different position rather than United States, especially after we heard about the encourage of armament of the Syrian rebellions against Bashar al-Assad. Do you think there is, or what is the what criterion govern the Russian and European relation with respect to the Syrian crisis and the effect of it on the situation, on the real situation now? Thank you.
I believe that, of course, we need to mention the Europeans. They were unfortunately ignored throughout most of the conversation. I think that the Russians have noted the new activism by the Europeans, especially the French, but also to some extent the British, on not only on Syria today, but on Libya 2 years ago. And I think this is a new situation in which the Europeans are being in the front line of those who want robust action, including military action. I don't think it sits well with the Russians. They disagree with that. They think that the Europeans, while not being capable of performing a military operation themselves, without NATO decision, without NATO support, i.e. U.S. decision, U.S. support, they could still provoke the United States into taking a more interventionist stance, as it happened in Libya. So I don't think that the Russians are happy with the Europeans. But again, as in the case of Saudi Arabia or Turkey, the Russians prefer not to to play it up too much, not to allow that disagreement to come to the level where it starts hurting the relationship. Of course, France is one of the key partners for Russia economically in Europe. Britain is also a very important country in that regard. The Russians and the French, the Russians and the Brits have held consultations recently at the level of foreign ministers and defense ministers to discuss Syria, and they agreed to disagree. I think that's where the status is. But on the other hand, the Russians do not take an ideological stance on military intervention, even as the Russians were very much objecting to any thought of military intervention in Syria, or even the lifting of the embargo, European embargo, on weapons sales to the sides, the various sides in Syria. The Russians supported the French on Mali, and they said it was an operation that was necessary to keep the peace and restore stability in that part of Africa. So it's very nuanced position, if you like. But the important thing is that the Russians and the Europeans have managed to deal with the differences in a way that would not damage the wider relationship, which I think is a sign of maturity.
Thank you very much, as I said, for the paper itself, which is excellent. I hope those who haven't read it will read it, and for spending these couple of hours with us. I think it was very useful for us, and I hope it was for our audience. I would like to thank Jihad Zain and Yazid Sayegh, who provided very useful comments, and for the audience who's been with us today. I'd also like to thank the technical teams, both in Beirut and Moscow. It ended up working just fine after some initial glitches, and I look forward to welcoming you in Beirut. Dmitry, I hope you're coming in May, and I think your colleague Alexei Malyshenko is coming in April, and we'll have another event with him when we're here. So enjoy your Russian spring, your non-political Russian spring, and we'll try to enjoy ours. Thanks again, Dmitry.